From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. As we said previously on an earlier episode of our new version of Strange News, we have expanded Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. That's right. Monday through Fridays, we are going to have a new episode of some sort, or maybe a golden oldie of another sort, hitting your podcast airwaves. And so this is the first iteration of what, if everything goes smoothly, will become a weekly listener mail episode. It's often said that you, specifically you, are the most important part of this entire enterprise. That is true, and that's something we feel strongly about ever since the YouTube days. So now we're putting our money where our proverbial conspiracy mouths are, and we are going to hear from you. Is that about the size of it?
Yes, that's correct. And these messages are going to come from all over the place. Some are just going to be a social media comment maybe one of you has made. Maybe another of you has called in to the voicemail system and left one of those. So you'll hear yourself on this episode. Or maybe you wrote an email that can get in here too. Really, any communication you're having with us may end up in one of these episodes.
Postcard, you know, yeah. like Raven, whatever you got, smoke signal, we're here for it. We want to hear from you. We said that at the end of every episode. And now, yeah, to Ben's point, we are going to use this as a way of curating more discussions. And we always, I think all of us enjoy these episodes. And I, for one, am really excited to make it a more regular thing.
Yes, and it is of high importance now that when you do communicate with us, let us know if you're cool with us using it on the air, specifically in voicemails and emails. Just let us know if you're cool with it, and we'll make it happen.
And if you don't want us to use your name or want us to be anonymous, just let us know about that too.
So who would like to go first?
I've got one here. I've got a message from Dave. Here's Dave.
Hi, Matt. How you doing? My name is Dave. I'm from outside of Washington, D.C. in Virginia. In my neighborhood, where's it, take a book, leave a book box, found a National Geographic magazine from April 2006. I'm reading the letters to the editor, and I thought you would find this interesting. And the article was Zip USA, Grand Central. This guy says, I read with interest your article, particularly the reference and photo of the secret rail platform beneath the Waldorf Astoria. My grandfather, Lou Friedman, owned Freem's LTD, the original men's shop at the Waldorf. My mother and her sister stayed at the hotel periodically. During one visit in 1945, a hotel staff member invited my mother to the secret platform, where she was one of a handful of people who witnessed General Eisenhower's return to the U.S. following World War II. I just thought that was very interesting, and you may find it interesting, too, to do an episode on with the secret railroad platform. I wasn't aware of that. Love to hear more about it. All right, well, feel free to give a call back. I love your guys' show, and say hi to Ben and Noel for me.
Oh, yes. So Dave, let us know about a secret rail platform that is underneath the Waldorf Astoria, specifically in New York. That's the Manhattan location there. I'm going to go ahead and start on this one, guys, and then we can talk about it. Ben, Noel, I think you guys may know about this a little bit. I know, Ben, you do for sure, just from our previous workings together. But let's get into this. So the Waldorf Astoria, as we know it today, sits between 49th and 50th Streets, in between Park and Lexington Avenues there in Manhattan. It's Midtown. And it didn't always live there. previously it was over in a different place. I think it's 5th Avenue and 33rd Street. It was a mansion owned by this guy that you may recognize his last name, William Waldorf Astor of the Astors. And you may notice that the Waldorf Astoria doesn't live there anymore. Now that's the home of the Empire State Building. Just kind of cool background there that we were looking into, Dave. The place where the Waldorf Astoria lives now, over there between 49th and 50th, it's been there since 1931, so a long time this hotel has lived in Midtown Manhattan. And it is true, it's not some, you know, weird story that lived in that National Geographic. It's true, there is a secret rail line, or at least a highly underused rail line that exists beneath that hotel. And it was used, well, for a lot of reasons, mostly to get VIPs in and out of the hotel without being seen. But it was used for a long time to ship FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in and out of the hotel so that they could keep, I guess, hidden his ailments, and to basically as a PR way to let him drive a car onto a rail, take that rail into the hotel, have it go into an elevator, go up into the hotel itself, and then drive out of the parking area essentially onto the street. Fascinating concept, right? I wonder if you guys had heard anything else about this Waldorf Astoria secret rail line or the history of it.
Yeah, track 61, right? Matt, you hipped us to this article on Gothamist that referenced an article from the New York Times from September of 1929 that sort of sets up the whole thing in this really great quote. Guests with private rail cars may have them routed directly to the hotel instead of to Pennsylvania Station or to Grand Central Terminal, and may leave their cars at a special elevator which will take them directly to their suites or to the lobby. The arrangement is made possible because of the fact that the New York Central tracks pass directly beneath the block, which has been obtained by the Hotel Waldorf Astoria Corporation from the New York Central Railroad on a 63-year leasehold, the lease being in reality only for the air rights on the site, which is always interesting. The idea of air rights is like, you know, that plays into the height of buildings and being able to like own part of the sky or you know, subterranean.
Well, yeah, I wondered, Ben, if you guys had encountered this when you were looking at kind of the hidden areas or underground areas on a couple other shows that we've done in the past.
Yeah, that's correct, Matt. A while ago, a merry band of videographers at the time explored facades and fake buildings of New York City. These secret trains, by the way, are not just a New York thing. It makes sense to have them. They're in urban centers in cities throughout the world. As a matter of fact, if you'll recall, in the days of YouTube, when you and I ventured to Washington, D.C., we got very close to arranging a tour of a closed down secret rail line there in the nation's capital. These underground or secret occluded rail lines make a lot of sense from a security perspective. And the thing is that now, in 2020, a lot of the historical ones are, you know, they're no longer secret. They're no longer classified because there are new technologies or new methods of transporting people, goods, nuclear weapons, what have you. However, I would say that the DPRK there's pretty good evidence that they have secret rail lines. Of course, Russia has secret rail lines as, you know, in some ways a legacy from the very paranoid days of the Cold War and the USSR. When we were doing our exploration of fake buildings or facades of New York City, which I believe you can still view on YouTube, one incredibly interesting thing there was that there were fake buildings that were disguising secret railway entrances and exits. So this means that even if there's a you know, a publicly known metro, you know, in your neck of the global woods, it is still going to have very likely some kind of hidden way in or out, not necessarily for nefarious reasons, but more so for safety reasons.
And this one, the logistics of it is really fascinating because, and Ben, this is something you covered on Car Stuff back in the day. FDR drove an armor-plated Pierce Arrow car, which is one you don't hear about anymore because they imagine they don't make them. But everything had to be made so big to accommodate literally driving that car off of the train onto the platform and into that special elevator. And then it would be, you know, lifted up and exit through the garage of the building. And there was even a situation where they would lift his limo and have to back it out into the grand ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria. And, you know, some of this stuff we actually have confirmed from Secret Service logbooks that have been declassified as well. So really, really interesting stuff.
And Dave, here is something that the National Geographic article may not have told you. For a long time, it was possible to take a tour of this hidden railway. There were some complications, of course. It's understandably tough to tour these things at times. I believe you had to have a membership with the Transit Museum just to be able to take the tour. And then you could see, I don't know how this is affected by COVID. They're probably not doing it right now, but you could see a list of dates and specific times, but it's very much, it's like touring the Federal Mint. It's not, they don't take walk-ins. You have to be sort of in the inner circle of Transit Museum fans, but you can go to www.web.mta.info and find more there, or just put a secret rail tour into your local search engine of choice.
What is it like? It's like $50, I think, to become a member, right?
I believe the tour itself is $50. You just have to be a member first.
Oh, that's right. Yep. No, that makes perfect sense. And I wonder if there's membership dues or any of that. But like you said, it's like not like anyone can just walk up and become one. That's interesting stuff. Yeah, no, it makes me, I don't know if you guys have ever seen, there's a documentary called Dark Days that's about like graffiti culture in New York, like during the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, and a lot of folks that like literally would set up squats in abandoned subway tunnels. So there's so much cool mystery surrounding like the subterranean networks of like a city as old as New York. And, you know, if anyone spent any time in New York, you know what a standstill it causes whenever they try to do maintenance on those lines. It's because the stuff is just so old. So there's so much cool history there. And this is a really great example of that.
So thanks again, Dave, for calling in. We hope that was helpful and interesting. We're going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsor, but we'll be right back. And we're back. Hey, who's next?
Yeah, next we have a voicemail from Vincent. Let's check it out.
Hey guys, this is Vincent from Wichita. I just got done listening to your part two update on the coronavirus that you just released, and certainly a lot to consider, especially if some of the worst case scenarios you discussed end up coming true. One thing that I'm going to be keeping an eye on is how the balance of power is going to be shifting globally, but especially in our own nation, especially with what you guys were saying about the election. You know, if that gets pushed back, we're going to have the Trump administration taking care of this entire pandemic from likely start to finish. And I'm eager to see if they're willing to pass some of the more socialist, so-called socialist policies that are going to be needed in order to combat things like the rising unemployment and the insane overwhelmment of the medical industry that we're going to definitely see. But I'd be interested to see if our federal government can maintain the power throughout this, if states aren't going to be stepping up and making more and more of their own policies and furthering themselves from the federal government, if the federal government is incapable of stepping up to the plate. You know, another thing is I know Ben often talks about how the corporation will be the new government. I'd be eager to see if, you know, lower income states like mine, like Kansas, if we won't have industries stepping in where the state and federal governments lack, and if they won't start soaking up some of the power. Because one thing's for sure, this virus is going to be a precipitous event for change, so only time will tell what direction that change is in. Stay safe.
Wow. Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of layers in that call, and a lot to unpack. And I very much remember that conversation that was very early on in the pandemic. I think that was our second update episode. But yeah, the idea of, you know, using this situation politically, and we've certainly seen that happening in more ways than one, but in the most extreme example of that would be to postpone or, God forbid, dare we say, cancel an election. And I think that's an interesting question and something that we sort of talked about, like in the realm of thought experiment. I did, in listening to this voicemail, do a little research and happened upon our old pals at How Stuff Works in an article, "Can the 2020 U.S. presidential election be postponed?" And as you guys may know, it turns out it's very, very difficult to do that. It's never been postponed in the history of elections in this country, and it would require the date is fixed by law and can only be changed by making a new law. And so it would require agreement across the aisle to do that. And as difficult a time as we see lawmakers having passing any law, I have a hard time believing that could happen. But under the 20th Amendment, the incumbent president, this is a quote, "A president's term ends at noon on January 20th. There is no provision of law permitting a president to stay in office after this date, even in the event of a national emergency, short of the ratification of a new constitutional amendment." What do you guys think? What about martial law? What about some kind of coup?
I mean, that martial law and a coup, I have to imagine, would be an extreme stretch. You know, and I don't want to be in a doomsday mindset about any of that stuff. I very much believe, at least since that conversation we had perhaps a little while ago, that there will be an election. It will just be, I think, fraught with controversy just because of the nature of so many votes having to come in through the mail and not through, you know, the ballot system that we've become accustomed to. Just as we've already seen in this country with the primaries, a couple of strange things occurring. Most of it, I'm hoping, is, you know, error within a new system being adopted. But, you know, you can't completely discount the nefarious actions of, you know, people who have an agenda or someone who has an agenda. I don't know. I guess that's my way of attempting to be measured about it rather than, you know, fearful of something like that. I don't know.
Well, let's approach this as a thought experiment. Let's do a decision tree of if-thens. So as you point out, Noel, it is a Herculean task to postpone not just the presidential election, but, you know, like the rolling election for the House of Representatives, which occurs every 2 years. We have seen runoffs. We have seen delays in specific elections, right? But never a presidential one. If there is not an election, that doesn't mean that the president legally stays in power. Whomever the president is, if the election is postponed, then their term is still over toward the end of January. And that means that Congress, which typically has a cartoonishly low approval rating — I've got a great list I should send around about things that have a higher approval rating than Congress. I think we covered it one time in the past, Matt, and maybe it was on a different show, but it's hilarious. It'll surprise you, and it's pretty accurate. But anyhow, so if there's not an election, then the president's term still ends on January 20th, and the House and the Senate have to divide and conquer. So the House has to somehow pick the new president, and the Senate has to somehow pick the VP, which is an interesting switch, right? But the House is kind of considered to be closer, to have a closer grasp on the zeitgeist or the desires of the population. But here's the problem. here's the problem with that entire if-then. Depending on why an election might be postponed, if there is, for instance, some sort of violent coup or some sort of fundamental change to the status quo, this is, you know, this is an allegation that surfaces literally every time there's a different precedent, right? Bill Clinton is going to cancel the election, or people probably even thought Jimmy Carter would do it. Personally, I don't think I'm not saying anything about his politics, but he just seems a little too, I don't know, nice, folksy?
Genteel? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, genteel. That's a good word. So we have to remember that if that happened, if there was a violent changed government, a revolution, a coup, a descent into chaos, then that means that the laws that apply to presidential elections don't matter anymore. They're rules for a different game.
But, like, you know, again, just worst case scenario, what if you had a situation where, like, military leadership was so loyal to a particular president that they would just continue listening only to him? You know what I mean? Or they wouldn't accept that sea change. They wouldn't accept that. Like I know it's not how the system is designed, but people are people, and who knows? I mean, I know, you know, generals are intent, you know, for all intents and purposes, meant to be somewhat apolitical, I guess. That's not their job to have opinions about which way to go. They're supposed to be able to take orders from the commander in chief. But what if, you know, we see this in other countries where there are military coups, you know, where a loyalist group, you know, loyal to a particular dictator or a particular, you know, very influential figure is able to, that person is able to wield control over those individuals. Maybe it's only a faction of the military, and then it's a divided military at that point, and it becomes some kind of infighting. I don't know. I'm being very, you know, dire here, but I'm just interested if that's even something within the realm of possibility, or if I've just watched, you know, Air Force One too many times recently.
I mean, these are great points. I think that's an astute thing to point out, because it's true. Military coups do happen. Right. And there's an interesting potential special case here. So, yeah, most militaries are theoretically going to be loyal to their governing documents rather than a charismatic figure or a cadre. One exception would be the military of China. The military of China works for the Communist Party. It seems like a small distinction, but it makes a big difference. The problem with the U.S. in the case of this kind of military intervention is one of the dirty geopolitical secrets about the military intervening in a government gone off the rails in other countries is that a Western intelligence agency often backs the military coup. And in the past, it's been us. So what happens when that kind of reckoning or that kind of process occurs in the country that's usually in charge of that happening in other countries? It's an interesting question, you know, and we know that there is there are very strict laws governing the military's relationship to domestic politics. They're there for a reason, but again, in the case of a coup, the we're talking about laws that apply to a different game. I mean, imagine if we were all playing putt-putt. I'm just going to say putt-putt because I miss the hell out of playing putt-putt. Imagine if we're all playing putt-putt and then all of a sudden, halfway through, or, you know, toward the end of it, the rules completely change and we find ourselves in the deep end of a pool and we're supposed to swim laps. We can hold the clubs, but it does not matter if we have them. And no one cares where the balls go. It's a terrible analogy, but I think it's important. And these things become, you know, rightly very emotionally fraught for people, right? And the idea here of a military intervention is, I don't know, it's just different. Like the military will intervene in various countries. As you said, Noel, there will be coups led by an opposition politician or a particularly ambitious Western-backed general. That happens a lot in the past. But Yeah. I don't know. We're supposed to have a an apolitical secular military, but as I think someone noted earlier, the military is composed of people, and people are the opposite of apolitical.
I would just say, Noel and Vincent, I do not see something like that occurring unless there is, like Ben is describing, outside influence from a power player within the world's, you know, within the world governments. And I, you know, if something like that does go down, we then just have to be extremely skeptical about the reasoning behind postponement or, you know, whatever action is taken to keep the current party in power. Though, again, I don't see it happening. I do think we're going to go through a changing of hands of power as this second wave that we're seeing right now of the pandemic, as we're seeing it really still affecting all of us and having a major economic impact. So, well, I don't see a power grab or a coup or something like that. I do see a very intense changing of power, changing of hands of power going on amidst all that stuff. And it's giving me anxiety thinking about it right now.
Calling into question the results, like you were saying it was somehow fixed or that the results are not legitimate or something like that, right?
Well, sure. I think that happens to an extent in every election, but I can imagine that this one will be highly contentious no matter what happens.
Yeah. I mean, that's another point against the idea of a violent coup or a postponement. It's this: the appearance of legitimacy is profoundly crucial to stability. Note that I'm saying the appearance of legitimacy. It's kind of like the pursuit of happiness. We're very careful in the U.S. government with how
you got a right to the pursuit, not the actual thing, right?
Yeah. And you want to aim for the appearance of legitimacy, even if there is some sort of shenanigan going on. So let's say, you know, Vincent, let's say that you're running for president. Or let's say you're already president and you know there's an election coming. You don't know which way it's going to go. You certainly don't want to lose because people aren't in general into that kind of stuff. But you don't want to win. You generally will not want to win if it will appear to be nakedly corrupt. You want to be able to, at the very least, convince some large portion of the population that the process works, because, you know, this country and a lot of other countries, but this country in particular is fascinating because we put a lot of faith in process. Some of the same kind of faith that empires of old put into religions and gods, we put into the idea of rituals and assigning dates to things and having, you know, as much as possible, a clear-cut path of if-thens. But yet, again, not to be alarmist, if there is something, if there is a, what's the phrase, a black swan event or something like that, if that occurs, then, again, the rules and the processes no longer matter.
Wow. Well, there you have it, Vincent.
I don't think it's going to happen. What do you guys think it's going to happen? I think we'll try to have the election.
Yeah. Yeah. Fingers crossed. But like we said from the start, it's an interesting thing to discuss. And we're not trying to freak anybody out, but certainly worth considering history and considering, you know, the possibilities. We're definitely living in, as the old prophecy said, interesting times.
And before we move on to the point about elections, this will come up in a future episode of Listener Mail, probably next week. I want to thank everybody who wrote in about the 1988 rigged Mexican election. And I especially want to thank those of our fellow listeners who said, "We get what you're saying about voting being a right to complain, but watch out because it's often misused as a nefarious tactic." So maybe we can explore that more in depth in a future episode. But We'll be back with more listener mail after a brief word from our sponsor. And we're back. Moving on, we have one last correspondence today. It is also a voicemail. It comes to us via Chrissy.
Hello. Okay. Hi, this is Chrissy, and I'm one of your listeners. I've been listening for a couple years, and I super love your show. And I really have to say, since you guys have gone into COVID mode, I really miss the synchronous STDWYTK with all of you together. I don't know if there's a way for you guys to sync your sound to do it with whatever audio you're using right now, but I miss that. It's a small thing, but it reminds me that we can't be all be in the same room, at least for now. Anyway, one of the things I was wondering if you guys could look into is this concept of gas going bad. I was very tempted to just buy a ton of gas when it was 55 cents, because I live in Canada. And 55 cents is, like, less than half of what it normally costs to buy gas. But gas goes bad. I learned later from a friend, not natural reasons. So apparently they put something in gasoline to make it go bad so that you can't store it. Is that true? Can you guys look into that? Because that's some bullshit.
Oh, Chrissy, this is a fascinating voicemail because my spider sense tells me that when you called us, you probably called around the same time that we were recording an episode about the true cost of gasoline. This is what Carl Jung would call an example of super consciousness, or maybe if we want to be a little less metaphysical about it, an example of a zeitgeist, right? Gas is on people's minds. But the question here is something that we talked about briefly in our episode on building a go bag. What you should or shouldn't put in a go bag. Is it worth it to carry gas? Without falling into the rabbit hole of whether or not you should have gas in a go bag, it is important to point out that gas does have additives in it, obviously, and gas does have a shelf life. It can vary for a number of reasons. Gas can go bad depending on the heat, the oxygen, the humidity. In general, generally speaking, pure gas, like top-notch gas, we have to define what we mean when we say it goes bad. What we really mean is that as a result of oxidization and evaporation, it will lose its pep. Think of the way a soda goes flat if it's open too long, depending on humidity in the environment. The problem here is that when gas goes flat, it loses its combustibility. So one thing that is pretty popular or has been popular for a while in the West, it would be ethanol gasoline blends. Those have a shelf life of about 2 to 3 months. The quote-unquote pure gas we mentioned will start to degrade from 3 to 6 months. But you can add things into gas, especially if like you have a car that you put away for the summer, put away for the winter. You can add stuff to gas that will not, you know, give it some sort of planned obsolescence, but will instead allow that gas to remain, to keep its combustible nature between 1 to 3 years under like really good conditions. I don't know. My question for you guys when I heard this email was, what would be the motivation for a gas killing additive? Would just sell more gas?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, presumably, and also, but the question there is like, right? No, I mean, if she's talking about stockpiling gas, it would not be in the best interest of gas companies. Wouldn't it though? You're still paying for it. I guess the prices fluctuate. You know, it would be the same as buying stock when it's at a low. You know, they want you to be subject to all the same ups and downs of the market, I guess. I'm just spitballing here. I don't know. What do you think?
To me, it's almost like a, if you think about it, almost like a subscription service. Depending on the vehicles you drive and the gas-powered, you know, machines that you have wherever you live, you're essentially subscribing to a certain amount of gas every month, really, because of the travel you do and everything, right? And so if you imagine the, you know, the projections that company X that's a producer of gas or government Y that has a certain amount of gas and subsidizes a certain amount of gas, you can look at an individual person essentially as that subscriber, and we know we're going to have this much use and this much injected, this much money injected into the system every month by you, right? And if you front load that, maybe it throws off projections. I don't know. That's just me spitballing.
You say subscription, and I think that's really interesting because I just signed up for a new natural gas, account for my house. And by locking myself in for a year, I was able to get a lower rate locked in as opposed to a variable rate, a lower rate. Why is there no such subscription model for gasoline for your car? Why can't I subscribe at a lock in a certain rate price point by paying monthly or paying for a whole year? Why doesn't that exist?
That did exist for some time in a for a little while in a couple of forms regionally. It just never took off. It never took off nationally. I think right now you can see services like let's see, there's Filled with FILLD, no E, so you know it's cool, and you're never on E when you use Filled. They can have that one.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
It's got that. Or, stupid. I love it.
Yoshi, which this service will come to you and they'll gas up your car. They'll also wash it and they'll probably take care of a smaller maintenance task like changing your oil, something like that. But the idea, I think, of people buying a fuel subscription was sort of like investing in futures. I cannot remember the exact circumstances in which this occurred, but it happened in the U.S. where people were able to purchase gas in advance from some supplier during a time when people were very worried about spiking prices. And then later, they would always be able to buy up to X amount of gas, however much they had paid for, at that price. So it's just like what you're describing, Noel, the idea of getting a fixed rate. But, you know, the easy answer to why that doesn't happen is probably because the people in charge of the current industry like things the way they are. It's always profit motive, right? There, you risk losing money if you do a fixed rate as a supplier. But what I think is fascinating about this question too, we haven't found any proof of a gas-killing additive that would be widespread yet. We know there's stuff that does mess up your tank and mess up your car, right? Putting sugar in the gas tank, for instance, is the old saw. But this question, to me at least, seems more like a question of planned obsolescence, which is very real and has been very real since the days of the Phoebus cartel, when a bunch of people said, we'll make more money if we sell light bulbs that aren't as good as the ones we make now. And that's happening. I don't think it's too far off. I don't know. It happens with smartphones, right? Those are built to be outdated in, what would you guys say, 2 years, three?
2 years. But yet they don't really cop to that, right? Isn't that sort of like something that we all know and experience, but Apple won't come right out and say we do that, right?
It's just the nature of the tech, man. It just gets better and better, dude. And then you put software on that old hardware. It's what's up, man. It's just going to break faster.
It's going to break faster.
No. I'm just joking. It's obviously it's obviously a plan to get you to buy a new phone because it's important that you buy a new phone. It's important that you buy more gas. I mean, do you guys imagine a world where, I don't know, I've got 10 barrels of gas in my backyard that's going to live forever. That gasoline, it doesn't matter that it's giving off, you know, or it's breaking down essentially at all times. I've got 10 barrels of gas and the apocalypse happens, guys, I'm set. I can trade for anything with all that gas.
At the very least, you can power all your crazy, you know, like demolition derby vehicles for the Thunderdome, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I don't know what I'm even talking about here, but if I as an individual was able to store enough gas safely that wasn't degrading, I could ostensibly sell that gasoline as though it was any other product in a secondary market, right? I mean, I ostensibly could. Doesn't mean it would be legal. It doesn't mean I would even make that much money off of it, but it does mean that if you were to add something to the gas that would guarantee it degrades over a certain amount of time, I can imagine that kind of hope that maybe you prevent those secondary markets and fluctuations that could occur within there. I can imagine that as a motive, but I don't think so. And like Ben said, we've never seen any evidence of something added to the gas.
This actually goes hand in hand with the episode we just did not long ago about the hidden cost of gas, you know, the big picture cost of gas. And there was something that was in there about the idea of spillage, you know, and like how much evaporates off, you know, and how you have to factor that in and things. It's just interesting. The whole House of Cards is fascinating. And as we know, I mean, it's obviously the only reason we're still on it is because certain corporations that have a lot of power want us to still be on it. And a lot of people that make the decisions in government are friends with those people, and they want those people to be enriched. You know, it's interesting.
And there's one last note here. To learn more about fuel additives, I would recommend the article on How Stuff Works, Do Fuel Additives Really Do Anything? Written by a fantastic auto journalist, Charisse Threewitt, who has encyclopedic knowledge of these sorts of things. I know her from the old car stuff days. The weird thing is, to your question, Chrissy, is there a fuel additive that can harm your vehicle? Well, a lot of fuel additives that are sold in your local auto parts store are kind of snake oil. They will at worst maybe not harm your engine, but they don't seem to help in the ways that they seem like placebos, at least some of them, other than fuel stabilizers. It's strange because there are some tangential, or I would say small, benefits, but often people buy a fuel additive because they think, you know, it'll make my car run better for longer, and it mainly just makes you feel good. You feel like you're taking care of your car.
Well, speaking of feeling good, thanks so much to Chrissy, Dave, and Vincent for calling us and leaving these messages, speaking with us, and bringing these really interesting things to everyone's attention. Really, really, we thank you. We thank you. And if you're listening out there and you want to join in the next one of these, make sure you head on over to our phone number. And hey, guys, what do you say in Chrissy's honor? Why don't we try and do STDWYTK and the number and everything together? Just as an experiment, we'll show her why we don't do it anymore. What do you think? Does that work?
I'm into
sure.
It.
Okay, here we go. In three different locations. If you want to leave a voicemail, you can call us. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. See, it almost worked. It was close. It was like a delay action. It was awesome.
We did our level best.
But we know that you are, I think I said this on our Facebook page, here's where it gets crazy. I'm a big fan of rituals, so I like when we all do that together. And even if the three or four of us are not able to do it absolutely in sync during these, our days of quarantine, it's awesome to know that many of our fellow listeners are chanting along with us. So here's the one day doing that in person again. Oh, and speaking of the internet, we're all over there. If you are a person who uses Facebook, check out Here's Where It Gets Crazy. If you're into Instagram or Twitter, you can find our show. You can also find us as individuals.
Yeah, if you want to, you can find me on Instagram. It's the only place I hang out, really. At How Now Noel Brown.
I'm Matt Frederick _ iHeart.
Woohoo! I'm on Twitter as @BenBullenHSW and on Instagram as @BenBullen.
And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, but you still want to contact us, and remember, this can still get on the air, send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.